I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Author C.J. Farley and I met in an unorthodox way. He was targeted by an AI scam claiming to represent Marginalia, inviting him to be a guest on the show in return for a, quote, production fee. Farley reached out to me directly following this correspondence, and after chatting about his 2025 novel, Who Knows You By Heart, I knew I wanted to talk about it because it dives into the implications AI has on one woman who begins working at a big tech company. Farley and I recently discussed aspects of his novel, as well as the realities of AI in our present world. Here's our conversation.
Thanks a lot for having me, Beth. So Who Knows You By Heart is a novel about a young Black female coder who's working for a nonprofit, who's facing some family debts and some other issues in her personal life, who decides to join the world of big tech because she frankly needs the money. And when she joins this big tech firm, she gets recruited to work on this secretive AI project that really challenges her notions of corporate responsibility, of personal identity, and what she wants out of her work, out of her love life, and really out of the world. It is not a work of science fiction, and really is a work of science presence. And it's a love story. It's a thriller. It's a book that deals with a lot of the issues that we're currently grappling with today in the world of artificial intelligence, but you'll have a lot of fun reading it. It's also very satiric, very comedic, very romantic. I tried to make it a lot of fun.
So as you mentioned, the main character in the book is Octavia Crenshaw, and a slightly lesser character is Walcott Neville. Both are Black. Can you talk about race and its intersection with big tech and AI? Because when Octavia starts in coding, it's prior to this current time when the novel is set, when DEI efforts are being punished.
One thing I wanted to dive into in the world of big tech that is not much discussed is that big tech, especially as you go higher and higher up the corporate food chain, is not very representative of the larger population. There are fewer women, there are fewer people of color, the doors are really shut to diversity. And now that in this world that DEI programs are becoming much challenged, things are getting worse and not better. The numbers at these big tech companies haven't changed much for the better in years, if not decades. So it's a real problem. It becomes a bigger problem because these companies are pumping out these AI devices and tools, which sometimes purport to be neutral and representative. And because they're put out by companies that are mostly white and mostly male in their upper echelons, these digital devices, these AI tools aren't objective, and they reflect the biases of the people that are putting them out. Years ago, I edited a book called Sex, Race, and Robots by Dr. Ayanna Howard. She's a great roboticist. She was at The Ohio State University. She was the dean of the School of Engineering. She's now going to be the 12th president of Spelman University, of Spelman College, historically Black college. And she made the point that this is really a problem when you start to unroll and unfurl all these AI devices that we think are so objective and we think are so neutral, when really they're encoding and locking in the biases of our society. So that's something that I grapple with in the book.
Yeah, you touch on that quite a bit, that AI is racist. This is a quote: AI bias is worse than human bias because we do not question it. And there were even a couple of references to digital colonialism. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, you know, years ago, I used to work as a music critic for Time magazine. And I remember I did an interview once with Prince, you know, who was then going by the artist formerly known as Prince. He was going by this unpronounceable symbol. And as the interview began, I put out my tape recorder, as I always do, because I love to tape interviews to make sure I get everything people say on the record and accurately. And Prince waved me off. He didn't want to have his voice recorded. I'm like, what's up? Why can't I tape you? And he's like, well, I don't know what the tech of the future will do with my voice. So I want to make sure I maintain control of it. I'm paraphrasing what he said because I didn't get to tape it. And at the time I thought, because this is way back in 1999, I was like, Prince is paranoid. But now, decades later, as we've gone through this AI revolution, I realized that Prince was prescient, that he recognized back then, he was such a visionary, that we would have these kinds of technologies that can manipulate the ownership of art, of voices, of the written word, and other things that people put out and control it. And he wanted to maintain all that control as much as he possibly can. So that's part of digital colonialism, I think, because right now we're engaged in this sort of artistic war, this creative war, this war of ideas about who really owns the work that you put out there. Should people be able to sample it? Because that's basically what these computers and AI devices are doing. They're sampling our work like giant rappers and not paying us any kind of royalty or any kind of monetary response to taking our work. And until we sort of sort out the idea of it, I think ordinary people are going to suffer. Our art, our work, our output is going to be colonized simply by the people who are the masters of these digital companies.
There were so many other references to literary works throughout this entire book. Can you talk to me about the importance of some of these works to you?
I've always been a lover of the written word, and I was born in Kingston, Jamaica, but I grew up in Brockport, New York. My parents were both college professors, and they would always have, great literary figures coming by the house or visiting the college. I remember one time Isaac Asimov, the great science fiction writer, he came to visit Brockport State, and it was great to sort of hear him read from some of his great work. And so throughout this book, I pay tribute to some of the literary figures that really inspired me. And in fact, the title of the book was actually inspired by Derek Walcott. The book is written in the second person, and this is a great poem that Derek Walcott wrote called Love After Love. The time will come when, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror, and each will smile at the other's welcome and say, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who has loved you all your life, whom you ignored for another who knows you by heart. And that poem really had a response in me, something I've always thought about. And so I sort of took the title of the book was inspired by that line, who knows you by heart. So throughout the book, I sort of paid tribute to some of the great artists that have inspired me. And I think it's also, it speaks to what we as human beings have created as artists and to not lose that connection to our creative selves in this world, this new age of AI.
Well, talk to me about the disclaimers we're hearing at the end of audiobook productions, yours included, and I think yours even had one sentence more than I'm typically used to hearing. What's that disclaimer all about?
Which disclaimer specifically are you talking about?
Oh, just that no part of this audiobook may be used to train AI.
Yeah, I think that's a big problem that we're all facing, that more and more, we're being asked to participate in the world of AI, even if we're trying to stay away from it. You'll find, things in agreements to use various digital devices that you can't really opt out on or difficult to, because they desperately need our information. They need to see how we communicate so they can build their devices to do better and be bigger. And it's hard to sort of remove ourselves from all that. But I do think there's a certain limitation on what they can get out of us and our written communication, because there are things beyond the written word that make up what it is to be human. I think the written word helps to capture it for human beings, but computers, AI devices can't learn about the whole human experience simply from just reading what we're written. And I say that because I once worked on an audiobook with Ken Liu, the great sci-fi writer, and it was a translation of Lao Tzu's Tao Te Ching. And there's a line from that that really kind of spoke to me. The path that can be walked is not the path that lasts. The name that can be spoken is not the name that endures. Nothingness, the origin of heaven and earth. Presence, the mother of all creation. And those are the words of Lao Tzu, the great Chinese philosopher. And what that means to me is two things. One is that the written word isn't all that we're about. There are glances, there are touches, there's other kinds of experiences we have that speak to what we're about. And then two, there's this mysterious component about human consciousness. We don't even know where it originates, despite thousands of years of studying it. And so it's unclear whether the people who are behind these AI devices will ever be able to bottle it and capture it. And so that's important. And also the whole notion of presence. I think embodied experience, being able to go out there in the world and be in a delivery room or be in a marathon race or travel to Mars. These are all things that you have to be there to fully understand what they're about. And the written word just by itself, in the absence of embodied experience, doesn't completely capture it. And so despite the fact we have all these AI devices tracking us, tracking every written word and every uttered sentence, they can't completely capture our experiences because they're not there, because they're not part of this embodied experience that human beings have. And that's one reason why AI, when it's currently devised, probably will never be able to sort of capture that full human experience.
I want to talk a little bit about names, because there was one part of the book where our narrator is talking about, I'm assuming it's a Taylor Swift character, because she writes songs about the people she's dated. She doesn't mention them by name. But there's this quote, "But the sad, funny thing is, once a detail is changed or a name, is it really you anymore?" And our narrator has nicknames for almost everybody, but not everybody. Talk to me about the power of a name and the power of replacing a name instead of using a given name.
Yeah, part of what I was doing there is playing around with what AI itself does, where often it hallucinates things, makes up citations and quotes, because it has problems figuring out things on the fringes of its training data. Another thing that I was doing there is actually drawing from my own experiences as a reporter and a music journalist. You know, years ago, I interviewed Taylor Swift in Nashville. And this is only when she was like 20, 21 years old. She was very young. This is around the time she released Speak Now. And I was struck by how much more she knew about the music industry than I did as his veteran reporter even then. She just had such deep insights into the way the business worked and into what she wanted to do. I remember one thing she told me she wanted to do at the time is she wanted to spend more time visiting the studios of other songwriters and producers so she could get some firsthand experience in seeing them in their own environment, seeing what they do, and so she could replicate it, because she didn't want to depend on the Nashville machine to give her songwriting partners. She wanted to write and produce her stuff herself. And this is from a very young age. She's already thinking ahead. And so that kind of forward thinking, that kind of control over your business and your art really inspired me for this book, because I think that's what's called upon in this new age of AI, to have artists and writers and musicians and entrepreneurs of all sorts really have that kind of forward-thinking control over not only their art, but the business aspects of it. And so she very much inspired, you know, Taylor Swift, and some of the characters and some of the wordplay in this book, because I decided she was such a genius at creating and controlling her own world. And even now, she's forward-thinking about what her response is to AI. There have been reports in the press about her moving to sort of trademark her voice and her likeness, and using trademark law as a new way of trying to make sure that AI can't take her work in unauthorized ways. Now, she hasn't announced exactly why she made those moves, but that's a speculation. And if true, it's very inspiring to see an artist at her level take those kinds of steps. And that's one reason why she's sort of an inspiration for some of the characters in this book.
You know, Pope Leo just came out with an encyclical on AI. What do you make of what he has to say about it?
Yeah, I thought that the Pope's encyclical was actually fascinating. I think it's great to see him taking these kinds of moral stands on things that are gripping society. I thought that one thing that really sort of stood out to me is the fact that in the encyclical Magnifica Humanitas, that he actually quoted J.R.R. Tolkien, one of my favorite writers. And I think in doing so, he did what my book was trying to do, in showing that art is not something that should be passively let to sort of be torn apart by our new digital overlords, but art can inspire us and even serve as a fortress against some of these ideas that maybe are trying to undermine what humanity is about. There's a line that the Pope quotes in the encyclical from J.R.R. Tolkien that goes, "It is not our part to master all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succor of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till." Those are Tolkien's words quoted by the Pope. And I found it inspirational because it says to me, you know, people feel overwhelmed by AI right now. They feel like there's nothing they can do. They're up against trillionaires and they can't stop it. And here's the Pope quoting Tolkien saying, hey, you know, take a step back. You know, you got to do what you can here. You may not be able to do everything, but if you do enough, if you do what you can, that's a start, and be satisfied with that. And that's quite an encouraging, I think, uplifting message to put out there in the world. And also, I should say, it also shows the power of art. The fact that the Pope would turn to a fantasy writer, J.R.R. Tolkien, who was also quite an enthusiastic Catholic, that he would turn to Tolkien for inspiration into how to deal with this new AI age. I think it's a vote in confidence. I think a vote in support of the power of art to support us during challenging times.
I did find it interesting how you noted in the book how, you know, tech jargon is working its way into our daily lives. We talk about not having the bandwidth to be able to do something, or there was a strong Bluetooth connection between two people. And that to me speaks about just where we are in this journey with technology.
And I think language is something very important, because language to some extent is being used to manipulate us to think that AI is more than it is. Now, it may end up being just exactly what the tech overlords are saying it's going to be, something that really is transformative and truly competing with human intelligence. But even that phrase, artificial intelligence, is something that to a certain extent is kind of hype. It's kind of just marketing language of the kind that, you know, Don Draper from Mad Men would be proud of. Back in 1956, when they had the first big AI conference, one reason why they called it artificial intelligence is because some of the other terms that were being bandied about back then, like information processing, just weren't grabbing people in that same way. It didn't excite them about the possibilities of this new technology. It also didn't speak to the idea that maybe this could challenge human intelligence. If you think about AI as something just probability matching or information processing, if you give it another name, then suddenly it doesn't seem quite as magical, because it's not really doing what human brains do. It's not truly thinking. All it's really doing is playing the possibilities. It's really just information processing. And when you think of it in that way, it suddenly becomes not as scary, not as magnificent, and maybe not worth the huge investment people are putting in it. Now, in the end, again, it may surpass those things, but for now, just bear in mind, these companies are coming up with these terms. They want you to think of it as intelligence because they want to make you think this is on par with what humans do, when really it's doing something very different to accomplish what it does.
You know, there were a few different themes throughout the book, but one is a word you just mentioned, magic.
Yeah, I think that the word magic sort of speaks to two things in the book. One thing is this, is that there's a certain kind of marketing that's going on with AI, where because AI is a black box, even people that are creating it don't quite know why it's working, how it's happening. That both frightens and intrigues people into believing more in it, especially if you're outside of the AI community. There have been studies that show that the more people know about AI, people that are truly part of the field, they actually are less impressed sometimes by what AI is doing because they know the mechanics of it and know that it's not truly doing something that surpasses what human beings are doing. That said, there's another part of that whole notion of magic that I'm speaking to in this book, in that, you know, people have studied what human consciousness is for thousands of years, and we still don't know, you know, if there's a soul. We don't know what actually produces this narrative we have going on in our heads. And it still, to a certain extent, is a kind of magic. And I find it fascinating that people would spend billions, if not trillions of dollars in investment in trying to bottle that magic in a mechanical device when we don't even truly understand it. So to a certain extent, we have an AI industry that is focused on, despite all of its technological prowess, despite all of the technicians and scientists that are working within it, that's focused on capturing magic. And that to me has always, I've always found that sort of contradictory and also really kind of interesting.
We mentioned at the top of the show that you were contacted by some scammers who used AI to propose an interview with me, and you were able to see that it was a scam right away. Do you have advice for authors who are out there who might be receiving the same scam, or for readers who might have concerns about AI? Do you have any advice?
Yeah. Number one, I should say that I did not see it was a scam right away. When I first got the message from someone who seemed to be you, Beth, I was super excited. I love the show. I'm like, finally, Marginalia is recognizing me. I can go on the show. And then when I got the next message from them saying that as part of the coordination and production process, there's a one-time production contribution. I thought, okay, I don't think that Beth would be asking me directly for money. That doesn't make any sense to me. And then I went back and forth over a couple of days. I even asked, are you an AI chatbot? And this thing said, thank you for asking. No, I'm a real person. But then I noticed that some of the answers seem very, very similar to the answers they had before. I thought, this doesn't seem like the real way a person talks. And it began to make mistakes. It called me by the wrong name. It called my book by the wrong title. And it kept on sending me messages. And finally, I directly asked it. I said, I called NPR directly and spoke to the real Beth on the phone. Who or what are you? And that was on June 1st. I didn't get a reply after that. So it's very disturbing. I think that one thing that I came away with is how disturbing it is to find out that something you thought was human, something you thought was real, was not real. It was AI. And it's a disturbing feeling, almost the ground being dropping away from you, that we're all going to feel increasingly in the years to come. And I think one reason why we feel that is because in some aspects of our lives, AI is not just a degree of difference, like, oh, a little AI is fine. It's a category shift, and that disturbs us, especially when it comes to art. There was a scientific paper that I saw that said that, you know, when AI is involved in some things, it's not like, you know, adding a little bit of salt to a meal, and you think, okay, too much salt is too much. It's more like a cockroach, where if you're eating soup, and a cockroach just puts a little leg into that soup, you're not going to eat it at all because it's now become a category shift from being something acceptable to being something foul. I think creativity is one of those things where we're actually actively repelled when we find out that AI is involved in it in any way, whether it's an ad campaign, whether it's a work of art, whether it's a pitch to be on a show. It becomes disturbing when you find out AI has done it. Someone sent you a love letter, and you thought, oh my gosh, they're in love with me, and you find out AI generated, you're going to be repelled. And so I think we're going to see that more and more in the years to come. And I think that one thing that's happening is more and more people are saying in different areas, they're guaranteeing that AI was not involved. We saw that with iHeartRadio, now has a guaranteed human component where they sort of say the podcasts and some of the other products are guaranteed human, that AI is not involved. DC Comics recently announced that they will not use AI in the production of their comic books. And so it'll be interesting to see how many more industries will come out and sort of say, like organic food, that, hey, this is guaranteed human, and you won't have AI involved in this. And on the other hand, more and more AI is involved in just the emails you put out there, the production of some books, and it's almost like they're trying to force it down our throats, because the more we have AI, the less we're able to refuse it in other areas of our life. So I would say just be vigilant about AI. Don't take anything at face value. Try to contact a human being to verify that what you're being contacted by is actually on the level and is real. And those are some of the steps we need to take in this new age of AI to make sure our connections are authentic.
You described Who Knows You by Har as a love story, as a thriller. It has some humor in it. Sometimes it felt like a horror novel to me. What do you want readers to take away from this book?
Yeah, I want readers to, one, have a great time reading Who Knows You by Heart. It is a love story. It is a thriller. I think you can have a lot of fun reading it. I think, especially in this new technologically challenged age, there's something important about spending time in your own head or with a book club, reading a book. There's a line from Rilke about how, and I'm paraphrasing, about one of the most important things one person can do for another is help them to protect their own solitude. I think books are part of that. I think we shouldn't get away from that. So I hope people really, you know, just have a good time in their own heads reading this book. I also hope that people take the book and recognize that we're in challenging times. I think about that last line of The Great Gatsby, about the green light at the end of Daisy's dock, and that whole line about, and so we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. And I think of AI as that green light, maybe symbolizing money, maybe symbolizing, you know, completely overwhelming wealth, this siren call that's calling us in with this promise of this incredible paradise that will come when we have AI that may never come to pass. And then the fact that the way it really works is by sampling what other artists have done in the past, sampling what we as human beings have already created, and trapping us in our own culture, trapping us in our own words of the past. And so we beat on, boats against the current, borne back ceaselessly into the past. You know, The Great Gatsby is a tragedy, and the age of AI could also be a tragedy unless we stop heading towards that green light, unless we resist that lure of the green light and come up with ways in which the wealth of AI, the training data of AI, is changed in a way that benefits a lot of people and not just a few.
Well, the book is Who Knows You by Heart. C.J. Farley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Who Knows You by Heart by C.J. Farley was published by William Morrow. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Each story you hear on Planet Money starts with a question. What happens if we refund tariffs? Why are groceries so expensive? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious, because the forces shaping our world can be hard to see. Follow NPR's Planet Money wherever you get your podcasts and start seeing how the economy really works.